This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That means we take an opportunity to talk with reporters of Northwest Indiana Media to find out more about the stories they have out in print and online. And we have with us for today, our first time, Alex Kukulka. She is the Lake County Government reporter for the Post Tribune. And first off, Alex, welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's go first on the stories that you have out there in print. The first one I've got to take a look at is the story you had out dealing about a concern that residents in Northwest Indiana have about the increase in the minimum wage. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I interviewed three workers who work in the medical field. Their names are Alonda Jackson, Isaac Culver, Cheryl Olson, and all of them make over the state and federal $7.25 per hour minimum wage, mm-hmm. but none of them make more than $15 per hour. So they talked to me about how it would benefit them if they were to receive $15 or more. And that's what we talked about.
Okay. I know you also mentioned about an experiment that was apparently done in Seattle, and you got to talk with some people involving that experiment. Will you tell us a little bit more about that and how that fits nicely into your story?
So I interviewed David Rolfe. He's the founder and president emeritus of Service Employees International Union, 775, and he explained how Seattle was able to increase its minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 2012, the union was supporting food workers in New York City for a fight to get $15 an hour for minimum wage. And in that same time, there was a lot of discussion from billionaires, one Republican, one Democrat, who were speaking in their respective political corners about the benefit of increasing the minimum wage. And also at that time, Occupy Wall Street movement was really picking up. So it was sort of headed towards increasing the wage. And in 2013, there's a town 15 miles outside of Seattle that was seeing a push from airport workers to increase their wage to $15 an hour. And that they took it up on a ballot issue, so it was up for a vote, and it actually passed by 77 votes to increase the minimum wage.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, my bad. Go ahead.
Sorry. And then in 2014, former Seattle Mayor Ed Murray was elected, and he ran on increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and he created the Income Inequality Advisory Commission, which Rolfe was a co-chair of, and they spent the first 4 months of 2014 looking into how to increase the minimum wage, which they ended up doing in like a phased-in approach, and now currently Seattle's minimum wage is at $16.69, so they're over the $15 an hour mark.
That's interesting. In your story, you also had a chance, and you mentioned earlier, about talking with Alonda Jackson. Will you tell us a little more about her and how she fits into a concern about the minimum wage?
So Alonda Jackson is a help-at-home worker. She cares for people in their homes. Who need it, and she's from Michigan City, and she started this position a year ago at $10.50, and now she makes $12.50,
mm-hmm.
After the company increased its minimum wage at the start of 2021. And she has a daughter who required two brain surgeries to treat her epilepsy. So her daughter has received a disability check for that, because she has memory issues and needs care around the clock. And Alonda told me that increasing the wage to $15 an hour would help her pay for rent instead of having to, you know, go into her daughter's disability check to help pay a little bit with the rent payments.
Right.
Would give her some more independence that way.
Isaac Culver is one of the other people that you mentioned, and he has an interesting story, but tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Isaac Culver is of Gary, and he works at Methodist Hospitals, where he's been there for 8 years in the Environmental Services Department. And he started 8 years ago at $10.75 an hour, and now he makes about $13 an hour, factoring in for, like, shift differentials. And he currently he's currently getting his master's degree from McCormick Theological Seminary. And he told me about how if he were to get the minimum wage increase to $15 an hour, it would really help him pay off his student debt. And I should also mention that his wife, who's a registered nurse, is also pursuing her master's degree. So for both of them, it really would help cover the cost of education.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way, yeah. And Cheryl Olson is the other person in that story talking about the minimum wage that you talked to. She's also involved in health care. She's had some problems, I guess, still dealing with a lot of them there. So obviously, making more than the minimum wage would certainly help out for her, wouldn't it?
Yeah, she mentioned how, you know, after when she gets a paycheck, after paying for the taxes, insurance, all that, she only receives about $400 every 2 weeks, but her expenses are higher than that. She has about $30,000 in medical debt. And so increasing her wage would also help her pay off her medical debt and even for rent, because currently she's only at $10 an hour, or she started at $10 an hour, and now she's at $13.84 an hour, so not quite to $15 yet.
Okay. In the debate, I know that is always coming up in the General Assembly is discussing the minimum wage. We know that the state Black Legislative Caucus has certainly made that one of their key points they brought up. And you mentioned in your story about talking with State Senator Eddie Melton of Gary about this. What did Senator Melton have to say, and how is that going to fit into the mix and the fact that maybe this might come up before lawmakers again, maybe next session?
Yeah, so Senator Melton really said that Indiana should follow suit with the other 30 states who have higher minimum wage than the federal level. And he said that he's proposed minimum wage bills in previous sessions. And this most recent one, he actually proposed a bill that would increase minimum wage to $10 an hour by 2022. And then the minimum wage would increase by a dollar every year until it reached $15 an hour. By 2027, but he said that unfortunately his Republican colleagues have not allowed the bill to be heard on the legislative floor, which he said prevents sort of discussion or even debate around the topic, even if it weren't to pass. He said this really limits just being able to discuss the possibility of wage.
Well, it's an interesting story you can check out in more detail online and in print in the Post Tribune. We're talking with Alex Kukulka, who is the Lake County government reporter. She also covers news from the General Assembly when they're in session for the Post Tribune. And Alex, one of the other stories you had out there is an interesting story that follows through on some very interesting action from the legislature at this past session. And in a couple of prosecutors here in Northwest Indiana are very interested in creating a cyber crimes unit. Can you tell us more about that?
Lake and Porter County prosecutors are currently in the process of filling out an application for a state-funded high-tech crimes unit, which would assist them in investigating cyber crimes. I know in Porter County they mentioned it would be specific to child cyber crimes, but both prosecutors mentioned how being able to have the high-tech crimes unit would help them in the course of an investigation to solve a crime.
Do you get the impression that in talking with both the Lake County and the Porter County prosecutor that they can do it, but that they would need the extra help? It's difficult in some cases, I imagine, to be able to delve into cyber crimes and be able to find somebody that they can prosecute.
Yeah, both prosecutors mentioned how currently they do have ways to investigate cyber crimes like this, but having the high-tech crime unit would shorten the time that, like, detectives or police officers wait for the results or the search that they need to do, because it would be in-house, so they'd be able to get the results quicker. And they also mentioned how this is something they've been wanting to do, but funding was sort of a roadblock, and now this grant that the state is offering would really help them fund these kinds of units.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your story as well about the fact that there are other cyber crime units, I guess you could call them, that are out there in Indiana. Some counties have them set up already. One in particular set up in Tippecanoe County, and it's supported by Purdue University. What did both the Lake County and the Porter County prosecutors have to say about maybe going to look to higher education for some help in setting up the local ones?
Yeah, so currently in Tippecanoe County and in St. Joseph County, they have agreements for these units, and they work with Purdue University and then the University of Notre Dame, respectfully. So college students who are studying criminal justice or forensics are deputized by the county prosecutor to work on these kinds of investigations to help with helping the cybercrime unit. And what we know from what the Tippecanoe and St. Joseph County units have worked on, they've looked into homicides, sexual assaults, burglaries, and other cases to look over cell phone data, cameras, computers, to like connect evidence or exonerate someone of interest in a crime.
Now, you mentioned that there's the application process is underway with the state prosecutors group to be able to take advantage of the funding that's available through the state, and that was made possible by the bill that got turned into law in the General Assembly. What kind of process do the prosecutors have to go through now to be able to apply for the money?
Both prosecutors have until the end of the month to apply for the grant to set up these cybercrime units, and the state council, prosecutor council, will administer a fund of $6 million to build 10 of these cybercrime units throughout the state of Indiana. And I was told even though 10 sounds like a small number of these units, they really will cover multiple counties. One unit will cover multiple counties so that the whole state does end up being covered.
Mm-hmm.
And in Lake County, they are looking to, the application asks for $600,000 to operate the unit for 2 years. And in Porter County, they're still calculating the cost, but it would require staffing and converting a space to hold the equipment. So that will probably...
Yeah, they've got a lot of work ahead, I suppose. And so getting the application turned in now is certainly a way, while it's going through the process, they can plan on some of the physical things they're going to have to make amends for, like you say, making room for some space in an office building or someplace on the county government center property to be able to work this out, I would imagine.
Yeah, they said they're going to have to convert some space and also secure it because it'll be a lot of high-tech equipment.
Well, Alex, thank you very much for spending time talking about this particular story and the ones you've had for us that are in print and online in the Post-Tribune from the County Government Center and beyond. And we've been speaking with Alex Kukulka, who is a Lake County Government reporter for the Post-Tribune. Thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking. We hope to have you back again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's find out what Carrie Napoleon with the Post-Tribune has put out in print and online lately. And Carrie, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
One of the big stories you've had out there, in fact, an update even as recently as today's editions in print and online, deals with the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority Board. There's been a lot of debate, maybe some could even call kerfuffle, between some of the members of the board and some of the executives that run the operation. And the latest story that you have out there is about a change in the makeup of the CVA board. Will you tell us about the changes, who is shifting to what job on the board, and some of the issues that are involving the board these days?
Well, you know, the board positions are staggered terms, and they always end June 30th with the new term starting July 1st. So mm-hmm. You saw a nice little turnover here with the starting of July 1st. The biggest change was with the non-renewal of Bill Wellman's appointment. Wellman has been on the board almost as long as there has been a board. And granted, he is up there in years. He just celebrated his 97th birthday. But he's still a very sharp man and was looking to stay on the seat if possible. But the lieutenant governor did shift or did appoint Andy Quinnell there. Quinnell was already on board serving as its chairman. He was Griffith's appointment. So mm-hmm. He vacated the Griffith's appointment and took over the governor's appointment in place of Phil Wellman. And the Griffith appointment then was filled by Matt Schuffert with the Hard Rock Casino. And he was also on the board previously, and he was the East Chicago appointment, but now he is the Griffith appointment.
Okay. So there's a shift around different people that had positions on the board only through other appointments in the past. In this case, you mentioned with Andy Quinnell, he was appointed by the town of Griffith, a town board of the Griffith at the time. So now he's on on the place of Bill Wellman. But it all comes down to us. I think this, Quinnell's name is always in the news lately, I suppose, because he's the chairman of the CVA, and also too
correct.
Because he comes into the little controversy that has been developing with the contract of the CVA's president and CEO Spiros Batistatos. Will you fill us in on that?
Well, this is the year for his contract renewal, mm-hmm. and apparently they began negotiations or formed their committee, which is their standard procedure, is to form a contract negotiation committee to work with him to come up with a new contract, which they usually send out a letter that says the contract is will not be renewed. Now, the dispute here arises over whether or not that letter meant we're not renewing you at all come December 31st, which a faction of the board believes, or we are in negotiations, we're not renewing this contract, but we intended on renewing your contract in some form, which another faction of the board believes. So it's like they're kind of pitted against each other. It's a tough situation right now. I mean, people, I think Wellman kind of really said it well. People have always kind of been gunning for Spiros's job, or if not his job, his salary.
Right.
And a lot of this boils down to what his salary is, what his benefits package is. And, you know, the board wants to rein that in, or has said they want to rein it in. But some board members just want to eliminate it.
Right.
Entirely and go a different direction. Now, the board has commissioned an HR study as part of their research into his pay and the pay of the other staff members, and this has not been released, but multiple board members have confirmed some of the content to me, and it includes the fact that, oddly, according to this HR firm that they hired to do this study, Batistatos is underpaid cash-wise for the size of the operation and the prestige of the operation that he runs. Now, that doesn't incorporate the benefits, but it does incorporate the cash pay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting. There's a lot of things going on here, and I think a lot of it all rolls back to this grant program that they've created, which gives $20,000 to each of the communities. There's a big dispute there that still is not wholly resolved over whether payroll protection plan funds were used for this.
Right.
So that is a bit of a challenge. You know, Batistatos does not believe they should be used for that, and that's his position. The board was able to move funds around to cover payroll, so these funds weren't directly used for that. But is it the intent or is it not the intent? You know, according to the State Board of Accounts, they did not improperly spend money, but was the intent of the law properly followed? You know, was this money actually used to fund payroll, or was it a windfall that they're turning around and distributing amongst the communities they serve?
I know one of the other points.
And that's what the issue is.
I know one of the other points, and you've mentioned this in your stories too, the latest one and in the recent past about this, is the fact that the CVA board has had some issues, I guess, and some of it's dealt with their law firm that they have worked with for a long time, and now the law firm has resigned from that, and they've had to put in a new attorney to basically represent the CVA board on matters. So I'm sure there are questions probably all about this. And you mentioned about this this PPP money and how they're shifting it around to be able to offer the grants up to the communities to help them out during the pandemic.
And that kind of ties into what is happening with the attorneys. I have documentation I obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request that shows that their attorney, their past attorney, Kafka Pinkus and Dolan, did not necessarily agree that the money should be used that way. They wanted more time to research it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the interim, members of the executive board pursued another legal opinion to see that they could do that. And then their old attorney resigned, and the attorney that gave them the favorable legal opinion was hired.
Well, I mean, more stories ahead, I guess, in the future, to be sure, that'll show up in the Post-Tribune about all this when they start to sort more things out, I imagine, with the CVA and with Mr. Batistatos, to be sure.
This will be an interesting next few months, Chris.
I would imagine so. One of the other stories, which is interesting now, and it's out there in print and online, is about the opening of a new museum in Northwest Indiana. And this one is a museum involving a bank. Will you fill us in about what the Schrag family has done with some very historic property?
This was really fascinating. They were in the process, apparently, of compiling like a corporate history of their own, just compiling some information and to create a book.
Right.
And while they were doing this, they came across just droves and droves of not only bank history, but history essentially of the Whiting community. And, you know, they have all sorts of interesting artifacts and kind of tell the story of how Whiting itself changed a little bit through their eyes as the bankers, but as their business evolved and changed from the three different or four different bank names it was, how big it got, just the whole nine yards. It's just really a fascinating and nice museum. It's worth a trip.
I know the Schrag family goes way back, and we know that the bank itself was founded back in the late 1900s, late 1800s, excuse me, early 1900s, by Henry Schrag, who came to the United States, came to Northwest Indiana, had a bunch of land, sold to Standard Oil so that the Rockefellers got some benefit out of it. Of course, that's what they used to be able to start the Bank of Whiting, which we know as now as the Centier Bank. So it'd be an interesting place to check out, I would imagine. Tell us more about how they got the museum set up and created and where it's located if anybody wants to check it out in person.
The museum is actually located in their downtown Whiting branch. It's open during regular business hours, so you could kind of go in any time. They're not charging to go in. It's kind of a free-form museum. It's a self-guided tour. You could walk, read the different exhibits, look at some of the interesting artifacts they have. They have somebody donated to them a vault that would have been used by lawyers or doctors or ministers back around, 1910 in that time frame, that they would have stored their valuables in before bringing them to the bank. They have the original door of the bank building. Go figure how they were able to maintain the door of the old wood bank building, but that's one of their displays. They also have a piano, and now somebody donated a piano there. Apparently, people kind of came out of the woodwork when they found out they were doing this museum to offer different artifacts that would pertain. They have all of their little bank promo give-me's or aways that they had done over the years. They have an actual bank ledger. It's not their ledger. It's from a different bank, but it is from the turn of the century, and it's just so interesting to see how things have changed. I mean, this book is gigantic. It's in a case, but mm-hmm. I imagine it is a very, very heavy book.
I would imagine so,
perfectly
yeah.
handwritten. So it's really kind of interesting.
Well, something you have to check out. Maybe you never thought about stopping down at the Centier Bank branch in downtown Whiting, but it's worth stopping down there just to see this new museum that they've created. And Carrie, thank you for telling us about it and the story that's in print and online and for your other stories today. And we hope to have you back on Regionally Speaking again real soon.
Well, thank you so very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Carrie Napoleons, freelance reporter for the Post Tribune. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A couple of Hollywood actresses and an iconic fashion designer headlined this year's Indiana Conference for Women. Inside Indiana business host Carrie Dick recently spoke with Billy Dragoo Garcia and Chelsea Anderson to get details on this year's event and its importance for women in the workforce. And here's the conversation.
Hey, Bill, I want to start with you. This is the 10th anniversary celebration, if you will, for the Indiana Conference for Women. And I can remember being at that first conference. And from that first conference on, it has been a hit and has grown every year. Talk about, as you think back on it, the idea for the conference, what it's all about, and why, in your view, it has continued to achieve such success.
Well, in the beginning, Deborah Coleman Stevens and I wanted to build a strategic focus, leadership and economic division for women in our state and actually our city and our state. But it's mushroomed into much more than that now. We attract multiple across the lines of industries of women, CEOs, C-suite. Now it's into the students across our state. And then we attract a lot of people from out of state. So this conference has become an ecosystem of strategic thinking, and leadership. And now we've mushroomed into the scholarships that we're anxious to talk to you about. And I'll let Chelsea talk to you a little bit about that later, but amazing 501c3 board that we developed, and we have great people on that board. Amazing case studies for this conference. It's, you know, 40% millennials, C-suite, across multiple levels of the industries in our city. And also 20% women business owners. So there's something for everyone. But it's, like you said, it's grown exponentially. I would say 20 to 30% every year.
Yep, very good. Chelsea, let's talk about this year because you have a big lineup. November 3 is the date. Some really high-profile keynotes and a lot of activity. Give us a thumbnail description of this year's event.
I'd love to. Yes, I'm really excited about our keynotes this year. We'll start things off with Taraji P. Henson, whom folks might know from her wonderful roles in Hidden Figures, Empire. She's also launched a new campaign to talk about mental health in young people, which we know is so important all the time, and especially in this last year and a half or so. Following that, we will see Jamila Jamil. Folks might know her from The Good Place. She played Tahani. She also has a wonderful podcast, and she's a host in a number of different areas, and we just love having Jamila here. She'll have a great conversation with folks. And closing out our keynotes, we have Betsy Johnson, who, of course, is an iconic fashion designer from the 80s and 90s, who just launched, I believe she has some purses and new accessories she just launched for us. So we're really looking forward to having these great speakers with us this year.
Yeah, major event, November 3. I know you've got some summer events planned leading up to that as well. Billy, before, we're running out of time, but so many stories coming out of this conference, right, over the years, the impact that the conference has had on individual women.
Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, Billy.
Well, you know, we've had some attorneys now doing business with folks in New York, like with Arianna Huffington, and some, I think it was Martha Stewart. We've had some folks when she was in town. Remember, she visited Long's Bakery and went to the industries here that fit into the industry. And so there's some other folks working. One of the students at Heron, Amber Ray, one of the authors that spoke at our breakout session, she's now a mentee of Amber Ray, that a book called Choose Wonder Over Worry. So these girls in high school, it's changing their lives too. So there's something for everyone. The studies that are coming out of this and the case studies that we're going to be presenting down the road will also build a legacy for this conference.
Right.
And the folks in our state, that they'll be able to reflect back on and see what this conference has done for our state.
Yep. And it's had a big impact, to be sure. November 3, the Indiana Conference for Women. Billy Dragoo Garcia, the co-founder of the event. Also, Chelsea Anderson, the executive director of the conference. Thanks for joining us. I know we'll talk about this between now and then as well. Thanks for joining us.
That's Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick with the organizers for the 2021 Indiana Conference for Women, Billy Dragoo Garcia and Chelsea Anderson. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana small business owners are making adjustments as we are trying to come out of the pandemic to be able to compensate for not enough people available to keep their businesses alive. And it's part of the latest survey on COVID-19 from the National Federation of Independent Business. And let's find out more here in Indiana. Barbara Quant is the NFIB's state director in Indiana, and she's with us on the program today. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks again for having me on the program.
Well, how's the situation been, according to the latest from the NFIB Research Center, locally, so to speak, as well as nationwide?
Well, overall, we are light years ahead of where we were when I first spoke with you in April 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the good news. There's some decidedly good news in this COVID report, and then also we just released our Small Business Economic Trends report for June as well. And so there's some good news there, but there are also some serious storm clouds on the horizon. Small business owners are still struggling. First it was the shutdown, and then dealing with the ever-changing rules and worried about the virus. And as they have begun to come back, they can't find workers. And as our latest survey shows, they are also now dealing with a serious supply chain shortages.
Mm-hmm.
54% of small business owners are having difficulty with that. So it's a serious situation. And we hope that this will resolve itself in the coming weeks and months, because if small businesses can't find workers, then they'll not be able to grow out of recession.
Yeah.
And since small businesses create most of the net new jobs, the economy is sure to stall.
Are we finding that, and according to the survey as well, that more Hoosier small business owners are having issues not only with getting enough people to be able to staff their positions, but getting fewer job applicants to begin with?
Yes, and that this was a problem before the recession. So so COVID has only exacerbated this. We did an Indiana-specific survey in May, and we asked them, first of all, most of the businesses were less than 50 employees. Mm-hmm. Most are actually between 0 and 10
yeah.
in the survey. And so these are the smallest of the businesses in our state, which really makes up most of the businesses in the state of Indiana. So we asked them, do you have an open position you're trying to fill? Yes, 88%. And if yes, are you having trouble finding applicants? 97% said they were having trouble finding applicants. So this was, Indiana was even more challenging than the overall country. And so that was, pretty stark. And then we asked them why they were having trouble, and it was passing a drug screen, lack of applicants willing to return to the workforce due to the pandemic, and that was 11%. And then some that were willing to work for pay that's comparable to their unemployment benefits. And that was 39% in the Indiana-specific survey.
What kind of adjustments have you found in the survey and in talking with Hoosier small business owners that they've been able to do, number one, to be able to attract employees? And what kind of things have they had to make changes in their own business model to be able
to
staffing?
Everything. Yeah, and there's still... The good news is that small businesses are resilient and are able to pivot and do and change to the circumstances. But my goodness, they're still having to. They're obvious. They're paying more. Salaries are up. I think there's a good percentage. I don't have the number right in front of me, but there's a good percentage that have increased pay. So they're doing that. They're trying to bring more benefits. They're offering even more flexibility. They're doing everything they can to encourage workers to come to work.
And I know from time to time when we talk, we have some anecdotal notes that you take and pass along to us as well, too. What have you heard from not only from Northwest Indiana, but just generally Indiana small businesses these days about how they're trying to cope with all this?
Well, they're as I said, they're trying to do everything they can. I know that there's one of our members right up in your area that I just spoke with, and he's opened new locations, so the business is there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's having trouble having employees, so that's a serious problem, because as small businesses create most of the net new jobs in this state and in the country. And if they can't grow, that's a harbinger of bad news on the horizon.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you for spending time with us, going over the latest information in this, 18th series, in the series of surveys from the NFIB Research Center about the impact of COVID-19, the pandemic, and all the other issues involving it on Indiana and nationwide small businesses. And we hope to have a chance to talk with you again with another report of another survey coming out. Thank you very much for being with us. Yes.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Post Tribune reporters Alex Kokolka and Carrie Napoleon for the stories they put out in print and online we got to review. To Barbara Quant with the NFIB Indiana office. And we hope you'll be back with us on Monday.